and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this episode of the podcast, number 215.
So, you know, everything that we had learned and kind of encountered, we could use that data to fix, you know, the 36,000 machines that are inside the McDonald's network, you know, the 13,000 machines that are inside Burger King, and just on and on and on, with hundreds of thousands of machines across the globe, if not millions of machines that could benefit from our experience and our data.
Or not. We all harbor magic and romantic ideas about the transformative power of both technology and the entrepreneurial spirit. Build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door, as the saying goes. That romantic idea is at the heart of many startups, and technology and the internet have created a platform on which a seemingly never-ending stream of new mousetraps can be conceived. Think about the Nest thermostat, for example. The iconic Internet of Things product, which stylishly reinvented the boring old home thermostat and outfitted it with brains, motion sensors, a cool graphical interface, and a powerful cloud-based back end. But technology can just as easily create dystopias as utopias, obscuring the operation of formerly mechanical instruments whose workings were easily observable. And technology can even trap owners and business people in a kind of servitude, like the sharecroppers or company town residents of the 19th and 20th centuries, whose lives were prescribed and diminished by the invisible bonds of contract and dependence, rather than by physical chains. As the Internet of Things expands from smart thermostats to smart automobiles, smart homes, and smart machinery, the chances that you or someone you love might end up as a digital sharecropper or a resident of one of these virtual company towns is growing. And that's what our podcast this week is about. In this, the first of a two-part episode, we're joined by Jeremy O'Sullivan, the co-founder of the IoT analytics company Kitch. Jeremy and his wife, Melissa, were the subjects of an amazing profile in Wired magazine recently by Andy Greenberg that described their young company's travails as it sought to decipher the workings of commercial ice cream machines manufactured by the company Tailored, a storied multinational whose equipment is used by everyone from the corner soft serve joint to giants like Burger King and McDonald's. O'Sullivan's story is something of a cautionary tale for entrepreneurs who think they might be able to carve a niche out of what amounts to software-enforced monopolies, whether those monopolies govern Apple's phones, John Deere's tractors, or in this case, Taylor's ice cream machines. In this first installment, Jeremy tells us about the origins of his company, Kitch, in a startup called Frobot, which was imagined as a kind of red box for ice cream, automating the workings of Taylor's ice cream machines and positioning them in self-service kiosks in malls, sports stadiums, and other locations. O'Sullivan's story started out as a feel-good tale about a plucky entrepreneur showing a much older, richer company how to improve their business, but it ends up as a much different and darker story. And in this episode, Jeremy takes us back to the beginnings.
I'm Jeremy O'Sullivan. I'm from Kitch, an IoT startup, where the best way to describe it, if you're not familiar with the commercial kitchen atmosphere, is to think of our product as a smart thermostat for the notoriously broken McDonald's ice cream machine.
Briefly, just sort of talk a little bit about yourself and your own background. You were like a management consultant for a while, and then you and your partner kind of just both kind of working in the consulting world decided to kind of strike out on your own. But talk just a little bit about your own background.
I'm from a small town in West Virginia. Grew up working in fast casual restaurants in the summers, like Bob Evans or Shoney's.
Olive Garden?
Not the Olive Garden, but places like that. You know, I didn't get as upscale as the Olive Garden. But I'd be lying if I tried to say that that wasn't on my radar at some point. So I'd work as a grill cook and waiting tables and that sort of thing. And when I went to college, I went to Bucknell, and that's where I met Melissa. We were on the same freshman hall. And, you know, in addition to taking a lot of the same classes, kind of venture off long journeys to this kind of local place to freeze and get soft serve ice cream. And we would even kind of venture off further to the more local kind of towny places, as we would call them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's
non-chain.
Right, yeah. Right. And even like places that, the students didn't go to. They were only kind of the locals' places. And so we enjoyed that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We enjoyed like thinking about the future of the commercial kitchen and what the future looked like. Obviously, this was the age of the iPhone and Redbox. And so, you know, the iPhone's pretty obvious. I think everyone kind of understands how that impacted things. But to me, Redbox was kind of equally as important, even though it clearly didn't. But at the time, it seemed like, okay, wow, this was a, you know, this was not just kind of a vending machine where you would hit A3 and some stale pretzels would come out. This was something that in my own small town in West Virginia, like we had just kind of gotten a Blockbuster built. Like our town had just kind of hit like the 20, you know, X thousand person to kind of, you know, be big enough for a Blockbuster. And then a couple of years later, it's like, well, that's right.
It all collapsed. Yeah. So just this idea of using technology and mobile technology, internet connectivity to sort of disaggregate the service from the store and the humans, basically.
That's right. I mean, I you know, for the first time, this was essentially a retail robot that could provide the same good, the same product as a store for, you know, better customer experience and kind of more locations for less than the cost of a store. And so Melissa and I started talking about, okay, this is clearly a cool kind of disruptive model. What else can we apply this to? And that was coinciding with, you know, here we were, I think we kind of had just passed the certified public accountant exam. And so here we were kind of like business minded people thinking about capital expenditures and income statements. And we're really enamored with this business model. And clearly restaurants just kind of never make money. If you think about it, it's very, very hard to kind of turn a profit in the restaurant world. And
your overhead is high.
That's right. And your real estate's expensive. The employees are very expensive. And so, you know, we were looking at this frozen yogurt business where you essentially walk into a store and everything kind of revolves around this frozen yogurt machine, which is really just a soft serve ice cream machine, and which most often happen to be Taylor machines or made by a company called Taylor Company. And so we were really looking at this business, and we were seeing that these stores were 1,500 square feet, and they would often require kind of a lot of humans to do things like pull the lever on the machine and then hand you back the cup and take your credit card and swipe it. And we thought, well, I don't know if you need 1,500 square feet or really humans to do this. I think people can, you know, you can kind of shrink the store around the machine and people can swipe their own credit cards. And so we just, to us, it was kind of a no-brainer. And you have this huge margin left over and you could actually turn a profit in this business.
This is in the heyday of the sort of Pinkberry and a lot of these frozen yogurt chains that were offering fairly expensive frozen yogurt in malls and shopping areas and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, we were essentially walking into a Pinkberry and spending like $6 or $7 for something that we thought we could produce for about 10% of the cost of that. And we would have this huge margin, and we thought we could very much just apply the Redbox model to this, and it would be a $1 billion business.
So this was Frobot.
Mm-hmm. That's right. This was Frobot. Essentially an automation package for Taylor's digital ice cream machine. And so what that means is we envisioned kind of a closet you would roll this machine into and with a couple connections, shut the door. And now this digital ice cream machine would be able to be untethered from its confined space, which was always the commercial kitchen. You know, so you can't just kind of drop an ice cream machine into a mall because you have no way to regulate people using it properly or portion control or any of that. And so Frobot would very much brand the machine, create the experience, and walk the user from selecting their flavor to one day, we never got around to it, but picking your toppings and, you know, then obviously paying for it and dispensing the product and creating a good experience.
To read the story in Wired, the problem you ran into eventually, and again, you were working but certainly communicating with Taylor, the company that made the machinery. They were obviously gung-ho on the idea because it would expand their market. But eventually the issue you ran into was really that these machines were not that reliable and they kept breaking down on you.
That's right. So, and you know,
a big problem.
That's right. That was, that was a big problem in our model, right? To kind of go back into where our head was, we had looked at all of the big frozen yogurt brands. We had looked at all of the big brands in general, and everyone was using the same brand of machine. So to us, it was like, okay, well, we clearly know nothing about this business jumping into it, but everybody can't be getting this wrong. Let's just presume in our model that this is a robust machine in which we can scale on top of. But that clearly turned out to be wrong. You know, when we were looking to scale, to finally go from one prototype to the next prototype, to actually looking at doing a production run, you know, that's when we actually needed to connect the two, right? So NSF, which is like the UL or the Intertek of the food space, they have to put their stamp on your piece of food equipment for it to be accepted by the local health inspectors and the Department of Agriculture's that kind of need to go out. That's the stamp they look for to make sure food equipment is safe for the general public. And so NSF has this standard that if you're going to have a standalone vending machine type situation for a potentially hazardous product, which dairy is, then your machine needs to know when to stop dispensing if and when the product inside a machine such as a Taylor machine would become unsafe. And so that's when we reached out to Taylor and said, hey, do you have anything that could help us do this? Do you have anything in the works? They said they don't. When we started saying, hey, well, we could potentially grab this data, blast to the cloud, you know, they basically said, to paraphrase, like, we can't help you, but we won't stop you. You know, we were at the Hacks Accelerator in Shenzhen, China. Taylor had sent...
You got investment money, basically, to go over to Shenzhen and work with, I think it's Hacks, is Bunny Huang is one of the founders, and get some really top-end, you know, engineering talent, embedded device talent, so on, to help you with this problem.
That's right. So Bunny was one of the advisors there, and it was just so cool to kind of take this piece of ancient technology, which is the workforce of the industry, and kind of roll that big clunky machine in front of a guy like Bunny, and just to watch his eyes just kind of go nuts over this machine, and, you know, to look at the boards and the equipment, and just I've never seen a person look at a microcontroller as though they're reading like a recipe on a cookbook. But that's just, I remember being really enamored and fascinated at that. And anyway, we, you know, we clearly came up with a way to pull the data from this machine and to make sense of it, just for the purpose of getting Frobot that NSF stamp. But, you know, obviously then as we rolled machines out, that's when, you know, as we launched two machines at Tesla 2017, you know, Elon had tweeted out something to the effect of, I'm going to bring roller coasters and frozen yogurt stations to the Tesla factory. We were like, well, we can certainly do the frozen yogurt station portion of that. And, you know, we actually got a response. And so, you know, we started kind of peppering the Bay Area with our Frobots, with Taylor machines inside. And, you know, that's when the data really started coming in. And we started this little tiny technology and device that would become Kitsch started revealing a lot more than we had anticipated it would. If you're like a Zelda 64 fan, it gave us this really unique kind of lens of truth or window into looking at these machines, because we were the only people in the world that were running these machines remotely. So if you're looking at this machine not from the perspective of it's behind you in a kitchen and you're hearing it and looking at it, but you're only looking at it from the data that it produces, it gives you an entirely different perspective and tells you an entirely different story. And so that's really when things changed, and we started asking very basic questions about this machine.
What picture emerged to you just in the data you were getting off of this device from what you developed, which would turn out to be the Kitsch product? But what were you finding out?
Yeah, so we would, well first of all, it became very strange to us that a fleet of these machines you know, this is coming from a guy who, you know, the biggest purchases in my life thus far were a Honda Accord and an ice cream machine. And I was thinking, okay, I bought a $25,000 ice cream machine and a $25,000 Honda Accord. This Honda Accord in year six or seven still works. No major repair is needed. No major work. You know, turning these Taylor machines on for the seventh or eighth time, because it was the seventh or eighth home game at Levi's Stadium, became problematic. And specifically, you know, kind of a year into running these machines continuously at Tesla, you know, we had to replace a compressor, you know, and this is just so many kind of repairs needed. And we started asking questions like what's the difference here? I mean, they're both kind of mass produced industrial products. What's the difference here? And so we started asking very basic questions, and we couldn't reconcile those two.
And what were the types of problems you had with these machines? Like, what would break?
The number one thing is that no one could understand it, right? So there are these kind of hieroglyphic buttons and error messages that would pop up, and it's just very opaque. So, and kind of this...
And obviously the documentation wouldn't clarify what any of that meant.
Right. So, I mean, you had kind of a situation in which, you know, a conscientious person who could get through 4 years of engineering in a college might be able to get this machine up and running. But your average food service worker, you know, which I had a background being when I was 16, 17, there's no way in hell that, you know, someone could kind of assemble this thing and get this. So it clearly wasn't built for its audience. That was the first thing. And yeah, then we started seeing that, you know, well, what's this hidden menu doing? Why is it there? And, you know, we had multiple owner's manuals, and it's like, well, isn't it kind of strange that it's not mentioned anywhere in there and that I didn't agree to this?
Yeah.
These secret menus absolutely contain fundamental controls to keep this machine operational. So it's the common denominator of these, of all the menus, is that they're essential to the performance, to the upkeep, to the maintenance of these machines. And here's why it got more interesting. It's one thing to have a secret menu with stuff on it that's not disclosed to you. It's another to be on hundreds and hundreds of machines, on an increasing number of machines, and see how the secret menu is changing and in what direction the secret menu is changing. And to have that kind of data, that's really when the nefarious element of this kind of came out to us. Like, what's the goal of this? And what's the software doing? But these machines, they just weren't robust. They would have, you know, many of them, if they encounter a power failure, they will reset back to their default kind of factory settings. But we can tell through the data that those aren't even the optimal settings for those machines. And so it's almost as though it's doing this intentionally to kind of constantly summon its repair personnel to get its owner to fork over another $300 or $500 or $700.
So for Frobot, did you guys basically just come to the conclusion like this is not going to scale, basically, that the vision we had for this business is not going to work simply because this core piece of machinery that we're relying on is just not going to scale to that level, or there are all these costs that we didn't anticipate and it just kind of throws all of our planning off. Is that basically where you came to with it?
Clearly, when we built this business, we envisioned a red box, and a red box that, you know, that just worked. And it was very apparent that this machine was not as robust as we anticipated. And we made a very flawed assumption in our model, presuming that it was.
So like any good entrepreneurs, you kind of pivot and you say, okay, well, this Frobox idea might not pan out. However, we've got this device we developed and there does seem to be a market for this.
That's right. This, you know, there are so many paradoxes in life. And when there are always two sides to every coin. And when you're sitting on a mountain of data, which we would figure out would be the world's largest data set for this niche machine, which everyone... just initially says, I don't care, that's stupid, right? That's kind of just noise. But it turns out that this stuff became very, very interesting because it, again, answered or presented all these questions. And so we had this data set that became super compelling and very interesting. And we thought, well, obviously there's a big problem to be solved. We have the world's largest data set. Let's see what this data set says. Let's see what we can figure out, and let's see how we can pivot from relying on this machine, as everyone does, to fixing the problem of this machine that the world kind of relies on. Like, there was, to say it another way, there was billions of dollars of infrastructure mm-hmm. to fix that we felt we had a unique perspective and data set and means to fix. So, you know, everything that we had learned and kind of encountered from our 8 Frobots out in the wild, we could use that data to fix, you know, the 36,000 machines that are inside the McDonald's network, you know, the 13,000 machines that are inside Burger King, and just on and on and on, with hundreds of thousands of machines across the globe, if not millions of machines, that could benefit from our experience and our data.
And this would kind of fall into the under the umbrella of kind of preventative maintenance data, right? And food quality, health and safety data as well.
That's right. I mean, we would see things like, you know, for instance, at Levi's Stadium, one problem that is often encountered is that with these industrial ice cream machines is that when you order like liquid ice cream or liquid frozen yogurt, it doesn't come to you from a supplier liquid, it comes to you frozen. And so you obviously have the problem of bringing this from frozen to liquid, but in the right time. And it sounds super easy because you just move it from the freezer to the refrigerator, but it becomes complicated because you have to anticipate demand and kind of all this stuff. So it has a tendency to be poured into the machine while it's still liquid, or I'm sorry, while it's still frozen. And so it became apparent to us that, you know, you could actually pour semi-liquid mm-hmm. or semi-frozen, basically icy kind of slushy mix into this machine and then turn it on auto, which would then cool it. And so what we saw is, okay, we have the data on this machine. We have all the digital readings from this machine, the hopper temperature, the barrel temperature. So we can clearly see when icy mix is being poured into this machine because it's below 32 degrees. And so, you know, we could actually intervene in the process. And so what we could do is we could clearly detect when it was below freezing. And so mm-hmm. before the human operator would go to then start cooling this already, this product that was already too cold to begin with because it was frozen, we could, you know, preclude them from doing that. We could say, you're not turning on auto. Our software will turn on auto when this thing becomes above freezing. And so we could actually counteract and improve the operating procedures on this machine from the cloud and apply some very common sense fixes, just like the one I'm describing, that just make this machine work better.
Yeah, and I know in the Wired piece, you know, they I think there was one comment that one of the biggest benefits that it provided wasn't necessarily even in keeping the Taylor machines from breaking down, because they would still break down, but just telling the staff when they were broken so that they wouldn't take ice cream orders. that in and of itself was a huge benefit to these McDonald's franchises, of just having the machine say, "I'm now broken. Don't take any ice cream orders."
It sounds so elementary that it almost isn't believable. But if you bought into Ray Kroc's dream, you know, if you saw that like Michael Keaton film, The Founder, which was great, you know, a lot of kind of restaurateur families are clearly in this business, and their goal is to be on the golf course, right? To not like be in the restaurant necessarily. And so if you have 5 or 10 or 20 or 25 stores, which are often spaced 6, 10, 20, 50 miles apart, you know, there's no way in hell you can be in every store every single day. And there's just this big disconnect between what's going on in the kitchen and what you think is going on in the kitchen. And one thing we started doing very early on is we started talking with people, and a lot of people would say, "Oh my gosh, this is so cool, I need it right away." But some people needed convincing, because they would maybe send an inquiry or whatever, but they would have some hesitancy to believe the idea that their machines could be off. I mean, this is way before McBroken.com came out, that gave real-time data from McDonald's ordering system. And so a lot of people were still reluctant to believe that their machines could be part of the 10, 12, or 13% of machines that are regularly down on a daily basis, which again, is just irreconcilable, right? Like, how do you have a mass? I mean, I can't think of another product in the world. I can't think of another mass-produced industrial product, right? That's yeah, so far away from Six Sigma. It's not even one sigma. I mean, I can't even think of that. I can't, it's unimaginable. And so it was obviously unimaginable to a lot of our early customers. But once they plugged it in, that's when they were blown away. They saw the data for themselves.
Kitch was a monitoring device that you would attach to the Taylor ice cream maker, and a variety of different models, I'm guessing. And it would kind of plug into it and get the telemetry from the machine. And then you could access it via an app or I think even via the web. And like, what would you see via the Kitch interface, or what do you see via the Kitch interface?
Yeah, so it was really just a virtual machine. So it would be just like if you have very, very similar to Nest, right? So if you have a Nest thermostat, you can see temperature and the status of what your air conditioner was doing. It's very similar to if you're trying to think of that. It's you could basically go to any kind of web browser, go to kitch.com, log in, and you would see your machines and you would see them in real time. And we had a great remote control feature. One of the greatest questions ever is, why would you want to remotely control an ice cream machine? And that question kind of, once you saw how finicky and down these machines were and the reasons why, and a lot of times it would just be a stupid thing like, you know, this machine wouldn't heat treat properly. And so it would be 5 a.m. and it would be asking anybody, it would just be beeping in the restaurant, hey, what do I do? Do you want me to heat treat or do you want to brush clean me? And it would just beep and beep and beep. But, you know, if you're asked that remotely or you turn Kitch Assist on, Kitch would do that for you. You know, if Kitch felt that it could actually successfully complete the heat cycle for whatever data-driven reason, it would optimize that part of the machine for you. And so, you know, again, it was just a lot of common sense cloud-assisted connectivity that would really improve this machine.
The focus of the Wired piece that Andy Greenberg wrote is on the McDonald's franchises and your work with them and your business with them. How did you kind of find your way to the McDonald's franchisees?
Yeah, they weren't our only customers, but they certainly became the most important part of our business. I would say that we felt this gravitational pull towards McDonald's, and it's just because as we roll out the product, just like any kind of entrepreneur would do, and any company has to do, is once you create a solution to a hypothetical problem, you know, you need to actually solve a real world problem. And so we wanted to get this out in the hands of customers. And so, you know, we put this out and on all the machines that it was compatible with. And so we put this at mom and pop chains around San Francisco and in Burger King's. And, you know, then as the McDonald's conference rolled around, you know, we attended that. And
this is a big conference for their franchisees and technology companies. And,
you know, it's important to point out that this wasn't McDonald's official conference, because of course we wouldn't be allowed to attend that. That's only for approved suppliers. But this was the conference for the National Owners Association, which at the time was from the outside looking in, it was almost like the best way to understand it is kind of like a group of rebel franchisees, kind of like you have, you know, looking at Star Wars, you have kind of the evil empire, which is McDonald's, but then you have like this rebel, this Luke Skywalker and this group of rebels trying to fix the system. And that's kind of what the NOA was at the time. Yeah, it's crazy.
So franchisees, but independent minded and looking for some room to maneuver and operate as independent business owners.
That's right. Well, franchisees that were getting together, and you know, and again, these aren't just any restaurateurs. These are like the best restaurateurs in the world, or the most successful, maybe buying into the right vision. But these are people who've watched their once great kind of hands off businesses become not so great, very hands-on businesses. And a lot of that was due to technology. And so a lot of these franchisees were asking, what the hell? Why doesn't our technology work? And so, you know, even though the technology aspect was only a component of the rebellion, it was still a very important part of their rebellion. And still very much is a very important part.
And was the problem, the technology problem, bigger than the Taylor machine? Were there other aspects of the kitchen that that were, you basically saw a version of this problem playing out as well?
Certainly technology, is kind of a big part of what's going on and kind of the rebellion. There are these things called SAM walls. I mean, basically the situation is that you're a franchisee, you kind of bought into this McDonald's system, but McDonald's ultimately has absolute control. They literally own the real estate under which this $4 million store that you bought and paid for is sitting on. And so at any point, and this is well documented, McDonald's, you can kind of fall out of favor with McDonald's. If you don't drink enough of their Kool-Aid, if you kind of start thinking the wrong way or asking too many questions, the 11 stores that your family owns, they might turn into 8. And so 3 of your stores might kind of drift away to more loyal franchisees. And this is what we've been seeing in the last 20 years. And so if you're a franchisee who isn't buying enough of kind of the current executive's vision for how many digital ordering kiosks your store is buying or how quickly you buy their new digital menu, if you don't buy their vision and drink enough of their Kool-Aid, you might fall out of favor. That means that your stores might not be your stores anymore or much longer. There's a dark undertone to what's going on. And, it sounds crazy, but there's so much of a, the only way to kind of understand the story is to realize that this isn't a simple relationship and there are a lot of players. And
could you describe actually just the relationship, as far as you understand it, between Taylor, McDonald's, and then the franchisees? Like, how does this work and kind of how does the money move?
So it's supposed to be a three-legged stool. So it's, you have corporate, McDonald's corporate, you have the franchisees, and then you have the suppliers. And so that's kind of one way to draw the triangle. And I think for the first part of McDonald's history, this worked really well because the control aspect, worked. So McDonald's corporate would get with its suppliers, and then the franchisees would kind of buy the equipment that McDonald's came out with, and it happened to work very well. But things started to shift, and the equipment started to kind of work against the franchisees. The franchisees lost their ability to kind of fight back. And so this triangle has become more lopsided in recent years.
McDonald's talks to the Taylor, Taylor talks to McDonald's, but the franchisees don't necessarily have a voice in that conversation.
That's right. It became a weird sort of three-legged stool. I once heard a joke or something like that. I don't know if it's a joke, but and it was one about kind of absolute democracy, saying, like absolute democracy is, or pure democracy or something like that, is when, two wolves and a sheep get together and vote on what's for dinner, right? And I think that's kind of what's happened with the franchisees, is that corporate and the suppliers have decided that the franchisees are going to be what's for dinner. Yeah. And that's the easiest way to explain what's happened in the last 25 years. And that's the only way in which to understand how the equipment has devolved and started essentially being hacked against its owners without their permission, without their consent, without their knowledge. I mean, these owners were literally buying equipment that was rigged against them. It's terrible what's happening with Apple and Samsung, but at least those companies demand your consent. There's none of that hand waving even going on.
McDonald's does give franchisees a choice of these ice cream machines. And if I'm right, these cost, $18,000, I think was the price or something. They're expensive machines. There's a choice, but it's a very short list. Is that accurate?
I don't think what's interesting is, you ask, well, how much do these machines cost? And yes, I think McDonald's has negotiated a price that's $18,000 for the franchisees. But if you and I, if anybody that's outside of the system, McDonald's system, were to try and buy one of these machines from Taylor, they would come out with a price that's 3 times as high, which is very interesting. And there is some speculation that maybe the fact that these machines cost $18,000 for the franchisees, but would cost $44,000, $45,000, $46,000, something in that range to us, is because maybe Taylor has agreed with McDonald's to take a loss on these machines, just like Xbox does, or just like the printer companies do, because they know that when you buy Xbox games or you buy printer cartridges, that's when they're going to make their money.
And what they're making their money on is the maintenance.
That's right. That's right. They're making their money on the maintenance, but they're not doing it. It's not just that it's transparent. They're not doing it in a legal way, because if you're going to kind of rig these machines to require service, then you need to disclose that, and so, or you need to have your customers waive that right, or you need to at least list the software as a component or a viable, or at least a contributing part of this machine that might kind of go wrong and create problems that way. Because what you have right now is people thinking that they're paying for a start capacitor or their compressor, when really it might be a software bug that was created not by them. And so there's a big disconnect between what people think they're paying for and what they're actually paying for.
Jeremy O'Sullivan is the founder of Kitch. Tune in for our next installment as we hear Jeremy talk about how relations with Taylor soured after he launched Kitch and the company's extraordinary efforts to get a hold of one of his devices. We also hear about some of the revelations from the data that O'Sullivan collected from Taylor's deployed ice cream machines, and about the lawsuit that he's filed against Taylor